Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. This week on the HR Power Hour, Peter Lowe, employment attorney from Brown and Isaacson, and a favorite guest here at the HR Power Hour. He's going to be doing the year in review. Great topics, things that really do affect you. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. And today we are talking with Peter Lowe. He's an employment attorney at Brown and Isaacson in Lewiston, Maine. And of course, a frequent guest here on the HR Power Hour. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Dave. Good to be back.
Well, thank you. And you know, we're going to be doing...
Happy New Year.
And Happy New Year to you. You know, we're going to be doing the year in review here. The year in review. Not much happened in 2015, right? This should take about 5-6 minutes.
Maybe three.
Yeah, what, 3 hours? There were a lot of changes in 2015, and I think probably as we look at HR today, they're looking at how that's going to affect them in 2016. And so why don't we start right out of the gate with probably one of the things that is obvious is the minimum wage. It's probably one of the things that certainly when employers are dealing it in 2016. We've just seen the change here, the minimum wage happening in Portland, for example. I believe there's other cities in Maine that we have some minimum wage changes. Talk a little bit about what you're seeing out there and things that employers need to know.
Yeah. The minimum wage battle, as you know, has been fought out on the federal level, then on the state level, and now on the municipal level. And from a lawyer's point of view, it's interesting because there's always been some debate about the ability of municipalities to set a minimum wage and whether that falls within their local control. But municipalities are doing changes to the minimum wage because nothing's happening on the federal level or the state level. As we know, there's gridlock, particularly on the federal level. So Portland has passed a new minimum wage ordinance. And in fact, this is very, very timely because the ordinance took effect on January 1st, 2016. And amongst other requirements, employers out there in Portland not only need to be paying the new minimum wage, the $10.10, but there's a requirement, as you might expect, of postings and notices. So the first paycheck... paychecks will be going out this month, and employers should be paying attention to the ordinance. And one of the things I just noticed yesterday when I was looking at it was, in addition to the poster that has to go up for employers, you actually have to post the ordinance. And it's funny because the ordinance is quite lengthy. It's legislation. It's a municipal term for an act or some legislation. And so it really doesn't read very simply. It's full of whereas and all those other nice legal turns of phrases that we like to put in documents. Yet it has to be up on that bulletin board with all those other policies, laws, requirements. So, you know, first item, I think, on many of your listeners' to-do list who are impacted here in the Portland area, we'll be making sure that they're compliant with this new minimum wage. Now, some folks may be scratching their heads and say, wasn't there a whole lot of noise and campaigning about a change to the minimum wage in November of 2015? And yes, there was. There was obviously the much more significant hike that would have raised the minimum wage in Portland. And for those listeners up in the Bangor area, there was a similar effort in Bangor to raise the minimum wage to significantly higher levels. Both of those efforts were unsuccessful. I think looking ahead, we can expect more municipalities to take action on the minimum wage or seek to take action on the minimum wage. So we'll continue to see. And of course, on the federal level, I think we've got an election coming up.
Yeah, that's a big year for 216, a big election.
So, you know, one of the things, and we'll get to it in some other areas, is you really can't expect much to happen on the federal level until the election, and the election clearly may determine lots of things. You know, if we're sitting here in 2017, we may be looking at a very different picture. Who knows? Or we may be looking at more of the same. But
so for clarity, if you're in the Portland market and you have an office or a business, you need to get the minimum wage posting from the city, basically. It's a document you need to get. Post the ordinance on, from online, I'm suspecting. And there's a document you need to post as well. So both need to be posted effective immediately. That may be a surprise to some. I usually get those documents from the state. So, this case, you're going to have to get it from the city. And that's an interesting twist to make sure that people understand and know that.
Yeah. Both of those documents are available from the city. I was looking at both of them yesterday. And so employers should certainly get in contact with the city if they have any questions about that. I'm sure I didn't do it, but I'm sure if they went online, I would expect that those documents are accessible. But that would be a good item to check off the list at the beginning of the year.
No, that's great. That's good. That's a great timely topic. So minimum wage, obviously, now done. It's in place. So from a standpoint of the wage and hour issue, let's stay with the wage and hour at the moment. And so, as you know, in 2015, there was a big push having to do with wage and hour on salary exempt. And the Department of Labor put out potential regulations that were going to increase the amount that a salary exempt individual could have. A minimum salary number. It was $455. It's going up to something like $975 or $970, somewhere in that range. They put out a big posting to, public comment. They got back many more comments than they ever expected, actually the largest in the history of the Department of Labor. And they postponed the decision to raise the salary exempt amount. What can we look forward to in 2016, is there any clear signals yet as to what employers need to be looking at when this might or could go into effect and what you're seeing?
Yeah. What I've heard from some lawyers who I would describe as Washington insiders, for want of a better term, these are colleagues that I work with who practice in the Washington, D.C. area and work with these federal agencies, is that they are anticipating that the rule that was proposed for changing some of these overtime exemption salary requirements is most likely to take effect in July of 2016. Now, that's reading the tea leaves, but that's what they're telling me. They're saying that it will happen before the election, obviously, and from a timing perspective, they think that's the most logical time for the change to take place. Right now, the numbers continue to be, when you annualize the salary, just north of $50,000. And you're right, there was just a flood of comments have been received by the Department of Labor. And of course, many of those comments are critical of that change. I think, not getting too much into the politics of it, there's a recognition that the salary level has remained in place for too long and has been static. But, here in Maine, of course, the notion that the threshold would be 50,000, that might be viable in New York or Massachusetts or Texas or, other parts of the country. But, that's something that my clients throughout Maine are looking at with considerable trepidation. And I work with, a whole range of different businesses and some nonprofits. And nonprofits in particular have a lot of salaried staff, and most of them are not earning $50,000 a year. So it's been one of those issues where we've been talking about it in the legal and HR circles. It's getting closer now. I mean, July is, 6-7 months away.
Yeah, 6 months away, yeah.
And, I imagine that it's going to happen and it's going to hit. And then folks are going to be scrambling and wondering what to do.
Yeah, we've certainly heard from people that we know as well that there could be, you know, something that takes it down a little bit, maybe into 45, 50, 47 range. But still, if you think the main median income is $39,000, small business especially, if you talk about family-owned businesses, this is a big deal. I mean, this is a huge issue. And so just to top on that for just a minute, you know, there's just been this talk about using salary non-exempt as a substitute for salary exempt. It's a little known part of the wage and hour part. Any comments or thoughts about using salary non-exempt?
Yeah, I have clients probably 4, 5, 6 times a year who come forward and inquire about the ability to use that. And I can't distill that into just some simple advice because it really is specific to every client and every client's situation. But it is something that an employer can take a look at. It's not a cure-all. I wouldn't want to pretend it is. But if you are able to maintain the exempt status of employees, it means a lot to the employees. You know, I think there's sometimes a notion that employers are shortchanging their employees by paying them a salary, not paying them hourly with overtime. But in the great majority of cases, the employees want to be salaried. They much prefer being salaried. It's not only a convenience issue, it's a prestige issue. There's a status that goes with being salaried. So, you know, what employers will be doing in 2016, I think, is seeing how much they can maintain that salaried status, that exempt status, in a way that doesn't violate the law. But, you know, realistically, many of the employers simply aren't going to be able to afford to pay a minimum salary of $50,000 for positions that the market, you know, you're involved in analyzing compensation, and you know that many of the salaried positions just don't value out at that amount.
No, I will tell you that from a compensation standpoint, we've already had discussions with many, many employers here in Maine, and CMA has been looking at compensation analysis, and it is going to be a real challenge. There are employers who have already been very clear that that is going to stifle hiring, because if they do have to do certain things, they are going to not be able to hire more people because they have to put the money towards maintaining some of their team. And you think of some of the employers that do 24-hour locations or that do or have assistant managers or shift supervisors that are salary that maintain and fit all the other parameters of the, you know, the management role, the supervisory role, but now they're not going to be able to be on salary. It's a big challenge.
Yeah.
In terms of it.
I suspect we'll be talking a lot more about it as the year
progresses. I suspect it's going to be a big topic in 2016 in terms of what we're doing. Well, you're listening to the HR Power Hour. We're talking to Peter Lowe about the year in review. Peter, there's really nothing going on. I keep saying that, nothing going on. Of course, I'm being sarcastic in the fact that if you really look at Maine today, there have been some new laws that are happening. One happens to be in social media. What is the new law? What's the effect of it in the state?
Well, in 2015, back actually in September, a new Maine law on social media took effect. It was one of those laws that the governor was going to veto. And if you remember, there became not only a debate, there became litigation over whether or not the governor had timely vetoed some legislation. And our Supreme Court here in Maine said that he had not. As a result, this became law. If it had been vetoed in the normal course, then we wouldn't be talking about it. So this is one of those laws, frankly, in my opinion, and I'm always acknowledge my bias as an employment lawyer who represents management, I think it's totally unnecessary. But it's passed, and it creates issues for us to advise clients on and make sure they remain in compliance with it. But the intent of this law was to prohibit employers from saying to applicants, successful applicants, you need to give me your social media passwords as a condition of employment. I've yet to meet a single employer in Maine who was doing that, who planned to do that, who would have done that.
I will second that. I have not met one.
I've done, as you know, I do a lot of presentations, and I when I discuss this issue, I say, raise your hand if you would ever contemplate asking for a social media password from an applicant or an employee, and everybody just shakes their heads. A little bit of history, and this is how legislation develops. I always think it's interesting to sort of just find out what happened. It was the New Jersey Department of Corrections, of all institutions, who had this bright idea. And they had a little bit more basis than most employees. They wanted the prison guards' social media accounts because they wanted to make sure they were hiring good guys, not bad guys. And they thought, well, if we look at your Facebook page and we see that you're chatting with organized crime, that's probably not a good qualification to be a prison guard.
As if somebody would be chatting on that. Right? No sense. No sense.
So some bright spark at the New Jersey Department of Corrections adopted a policy to require applicants to provide their passwords. So the ACLU leapt into the fray appropriately and challenged that, questioned that. The spinoff from all of that was legislation that was passed in New Jersey. And what happens then is I think Delaware passed a law, and it sort of had that creep around the country that people said, you know, we need to prevent this abuse by employers of applicants. You know, it just wasn't happening. And as a consequence, here in Maine, we got our own law. That part of it's simple, but like many of these laws, the devil lies in the details. And there are some important details for employees to observe, particularly when they're doing investigations. So there is a new provision that defines social media and social media data very broadly. And it's not simply going in and asking for passwords or looking at an employee's Facebook, which would typically be what I think most people would understand as social media. Email, text, other electronic communications fall within the definition of social media. So I'm simplifying the law, but as a general proposition, employers cannot require employees to provide the employer with access to personal email, personal text, personal communications, and that is a change. I don't think employers were doing that as a whole. There's always a few rogues out there or a few who may be doing things like that. But when you're in an investigation and you're dealing with a sexual harassment case, as we know, those harassment cases know no boundaries these days. It used to be that you were dealing with a workplace issue and what happened in the warehouse. But today, if one of your employees is being harassed by receiving endless texts from a coworker on her personal phone, from his personal phone, happening after hours, that has the potential to become a workplace harassment issue. So you can imagine that HR would say to both of those, the harassed and the harasser, I want to see these texts. And the short answer is HR or management can still make that request if it's in the course of an investigation. And essentially, if you're pursuing that information in good faith, and you're using that information only in connection with the investigation, there is a carve-out exception. But that's something for folks to be vigilant about. I think probably most of the HR world gets sick of us saying, you need a new policy. you know, there's endless policies. But if you have a social media policy, which my guess is about 50% of employers do at this point here in Maine, then you should be looking at that policy and you should be considering making some changes to reflect this new law. And they're pretty simple changes, in fact, but that's something that should be on the 2016 to-do list if you didn't get to it in 2015.
We're talking with Peter Lowe, attorney from Brown and Isaacson, and we're talking about the year in review. Okay, so social media certainly was big last year and carries into this year. What are some of the trends you're seeing in another area, the America for Disabilities Act?
Yeah, the ADA is the gift that keeps on giving for lawyers. I deal with employment issues all day long, and discrimination issues in particular. And still, the number one issue is disability, disability discrimination cases. And at the heart of ADA cases, it used to be the whether or not an employee was disabled. And changes a number of years ago now in Maine law and federal law have made it a lot easier to meet that definition of disability. So the focus now in the litigation, and frankly in the advice that, we're giving to clients, is whether or not an accommodation is reasonable. And one of the interesting areas that I've seen emerge is what you and I would probably refer to as telecommuting. And I just last week noticed that the term is emerging of telework. So you heard it first.
Telework.
On your show, Dave.
The HR Power Hour, telework.
Telework. We'll introduce that term. But it really is the same as telecommuting. But here's the issue, and I know lots of employees are familiar with it already. You have an employee who has a medical condition that impacts their ability to drive, or it impacts their ability to be in the office. And you know, one that was in a recent case, and I've dealt with myself for clients, is an employee with irritable bowel syndrome. And the employee, a significant medical condition, says, I really can't leave home. I need to be at home, but I can work. And the tension here is, yes, employers want employees to be accommodated. They want employees to be able to work, but they want them to come to work. Because there is still, in the minds of many employers, and in fact courts as well, this understandable notion that working from home is not a substitute for working in the office. And by that, I don't mean that people aren't going to work at home. There's plenty of I wouldn't be one of them, frankly, to be honest. But there are plenty of people who have the discipline and the ability to function and work at home. But what they miss is the teamwork, the collegiality, the interaction, all of those things. And so the debate that's happened and it's gone into the courtroom now is whether or not coming to work and actually being at work with your coworkers is an essential function of the job. Because under the Americans with Disabilities Act, you're not required as an employer to remove essential functions of the job. So these cases have gone to court, and the employee has said, you should allow me to work at home. It's reasonable to let me work at home. I can take my phone calls. I can get on my computer. I can send emails. I can do all of those things. And the employer says, yes, I understand that, but it is essential still for you to come to the office. Sometimes, at least. And the employee says, I can't, regrettably. And a case involving Ford Motor Company and the EEOC came down last year. I think it was one of the Federal Court of Appeals, which is that rung below the Supreme Court. It wasn't the First Circuit, which controls Maine. It was the Sixth Circuit. But the ruling said that it was an essential function of this person's job to come into the office and come in on a regular and routine basis and interact with your coworkers. It was an interesting decision because this is sort of inside baseball, but the appeals court initially ruled in favor of the employee, 2-1. You have 3 judges. And then very, very rarely all of the judges decide a case. So this case was decided 8-5, 8 in favor of the Ford Motor Company, 5 in favor of the employee. That sort of split is quite unusual, and I think it indicates that this issue is going to play out and continue to play out, and there's going to be, you can see, you know, as I'm describing it, there's really 2 sides to this, and both sides have, you know, a reasonable basis. A takeaway for your listeners is that whenever you deal with an accommodation issue under the ADA, you can't set hard and fast rules. You have to be individualized. So if you're listening and saying, oh, Peter's advice is we don't have to accommodate telework or telecommuting. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying is that you have to determine whether working in your office, plant, factory is an essential function or not, and that will be one of the key issues. And this ruling is one that's tipping towards it being an essential function, but that's not always going to be the analysis.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour, and we will be right back on News Talk WLOB.
If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
Dale Carnegie Training specializes in building high-performing individuals and teams, and Dale Carnegie Maine provides public courses that do just that. On January 6, a one-day Step Up to Leadership course. January 21 starts an 8-week Dale Carnegie course. January 25 starts a 3-week Dale Carnegie Sales Training course. To sign up or get more info, go to maine.dalecarnegie.com or call 775-3253.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. And today we're talking with Peter Lowe, attorney at Brown & Isaacson, and we are talking about the year in review. We've certainly had a first half of social media, wage and hour, minimum wage, and ADA. In the second half of the show, and I'm going to give a little tease for the audience so that you guys can stay on, Peter's going to talk a little bit about Deflategate, Tom Brady, and how that can affect HR. Yes, that's coming up. But in the meantime, let's talk about the stuff that is critically important to the organization.
Oh, Don.
I know. And let's talk about an EEOC update that has happened. Talk a little about the criminal background check changes that are happening out there.
Sure. The EEOC has a strategic enforcement plan. And in fact, it's not new. It's been in effect. I think they first adopted it in 2013. But it remains the strategic plan for 2016. And this, again, is a reflection of the inability of Congress to pass any legislation. So without legislation being passed, the administration said, these are going to be our goals, these are going to be our initiatives. And one that continues to be a major initiative and focus for the EEOC, the federal agency in Washington, is criminal background checks. And by way of example, and stay tuned right now if you're involved with the federal government, back I think it was in July, I'm not good at remembering dates, President Obama signed an executive order that adopted this ban the box requirement.
For applications, yes.
Yeah, so for those...
That's only for federal contractors.
That's
though.
Right. At this point, and right now, it's applying to the federal government. There's the notion that it will be expanded, or at least that's the intent to expand it. But I forget the number now, but I think it's 10, 15 states have passed their own ban the box legislation.
Now, why don't you explain ban the box? I think it's important.
So what? Look at your employment application. And if your employment application, like many employers, was developed in the 90s, in the early 2000s, very likely you've got on there a question that says, have you been convicted of any crimes? By the way, if it says, have you ever been arrested, take that off immediately. That really is an inappropriate question for an employer to pose. I don't see that very often, but I do see the question, have you been convicted of any crimes?
Yeah, and it usually may say something like misdemeanors don't count or traffic violations.
Right, and it might say only when you're over 18, not as a juvenile. So sometimes there's disclaimers or explanations. And then quite often it will say below that, this won't necessarily disqualify you from employment. Well, public policy is developing to ban that question. And it's happening through state legislation. New York, a number of years ago, passed some quite expansive legislation to not simply address that issue, but address criminal convictions. The issue is the following one, and the numbers back it up. There is an extraordinarily high number of applicants who somewhere in their background have had involvement with law enforcement and indeed convictions. And there at least has been some research and some anecdotal evidence to suggest that that has made a large part of our population unemployable. And so the EEOC and state legislatures has taken the position that that question doesn't belong on the application. So if you're in one of these states that has passed ban the box legislation, it's now illegal to have that question on your application form. It's not illegal in Maine. However, if you're hiring in another state or you're, if you think about it now, the application for lots of our employers is online. And so if I'm applying from a ban the box state, there's certainly an argument that that applicant can make is that the law that applies is the law in the state where I'm applying for my job, not Maine law. So you can see that issue coming along. As a best practice, I'm advising our clients now not to include that question on the application. It can be included separately. It can be provided to the employee or applicant after a job offer is made. And I'm a believer that best practices, regardless of the size of the employer, is to do a criminal background check. So for those of you who are concerned, well, if we don't ask that question, we're not going to know whether the person, you know, is a felon. If you're doing criminal background checks, you're going to find that out anyway. And you know, criminal background checks are available. There are certain, you know, companies that provide that as a service. Of course, there's a cost that's associated with it. So that, I think, is going to just be an increasing trend. And I think we'll see at some point that Maine may well go that same way and so-called ban that box, ban that question on the form. The EEOC continues to bring claims. In 2015, BMW, a massive entity, got sued in a class action case and had to pay in excess of $1 million for not getting this criminal background check process right. And one change that your listeners, I'm sure they read about you too, Dave.
Of course they do. They can go to HRPowerHour.com and read about us. Sure.
God, what a shameless plug. This is getting technical. So did you drink coffee? Because
we've drank coffee here on Saturday morning. Yes.
I saw those lids getting a little heavy listening to this part. But it's important, in fact. In the last year, the EEOC and the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, came out with some joint tips, as they refer to them, because if you are doing criminal background checks, then an employer must comply with the Federal Credit Reporting Act. And there's now a requirement, again, relating to the forms that you use. And the government has taken the position that with an applicant, when you get the consent from an applicant to do a criminal background check, it shouldn't be on an application. It shouldn't be on a form that addresses other items. It should be on its own separate form, its own separate document. And now we're doing things electronically more often than not. It has to be, if you like, a separate page on the website. And so I've worked with some clients. It's a very technical issue, but there have been class action lawsuits now brought against some employers simply for not doing that. So it's a sort of a area of compliance that wouldn't necessarily come first to mind.
No, I think that's an important one because a lot of people, not only on the application, have language like that. You talk about language about being the box, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Most of the time on the backside or on somewhere on there, it says you hereby, you know, agree to that everything's true and your background and blah, 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 blah. So that is language that should be looked at and determined. What else was happening at the NLRB? We've talked about the EEOC. How about the NLRB? What are changes there?
So we're using all these acronyms for folks, but the National Labor Relations Board is the federal agency that enforces the National Labor Relations Act. And they're continuing on the path to be very, very aggressive in the area of social media. And so there's not a social media policy that passes muster with them. I'm exaggerating, but it is true that the NLRB will look at a social media policy if there's a challenge to the policy or if there was a termination based upon the policy. And they've struck down policies that require employees to act respectfully. They've struck down policies that which state that an employee should not disparage the company. And I think a lot of your listeners will be familiar with the reason. The NLRB says that employees have a right to engage in protected, concerted activity. So if they want to unionize or think about unionizing and criticize the company, a prohibition on disparagement or a requirement that they act respectfully may not be consistent with those rights. So there really is more and more of the same on that. We work with employers and handbooks a lot. And frankly, the conversation I have often with employers is, if you want a handbook that literally complies with all of the mandates of the National Labor Relations Board, then you really may dumb it down so it doesn't say what you want. However, it can be crafted in such a way that would give you good faith defense to that. But more significantly, you know, how many employers are facing enforcement actions by the NLRB? It's not very frequent. If you're in a climate where you're facing organizing or you may face organizing, then you may want to pay closer scrutiny and attention. But so that's been sort of, again, one of the primary areas for the NLRB. The other thing, you know, as I think most listeners would know, is that the rule for quickie elections truncated the time for an election to take place when there's union organizing, went into effect in 2015. It's really too early to tell whether that's resulted in a drastic change or not, but time will tell. If you face organizing in your workplace, it frankly will happen, and there will be an election if a petition is filed in a briefer period than previously was the case. So stay tuned on that one.
So we've had the EEOC with the NLRB. One of the things I did wanted to quickly talk about in this segment before we get to the big cases of 215 and the Tom Brady special that we're going to talk about, the Deflategate. How about marijuana in the workplace? We know certainly in Maine that's probably going to be on the ballot in 216, and that could certainly, from a recreational side, change things. Where do you see, are there any changes that we need to be aware about, excluding that potential new issue that's coming up?
Yeah. So we'll all wait and see what happens with recreational marijuana. As a practitioner, I'm seeing more and more questions about marijuana and medical marijuana in particular showing up for those employers who do drug testing. The Department of Labor had a work study group, I think that was the right title, that I participated in 2015 to look at whether there should be changes in the drug testing laws here in Maine and the medical marijuana law. And I'll give them credit. You know, we sometimes criticize the government, and sometimes they deserve it. In this case, I thought the Department of Labor really put together, you know, a really concerted effort to listen to all sides. And it was a fascinating discussion because you had the people who represent the dispensaries, those who are medical marijuana users, and then, you know, the employer community. And I suspect we may see the Department of Labor come out with some proposals to change the law. And of course, it will remains to see what happens in the legislature. The biggest issue, and the one that everyone's wrestling with, is what does it mean to be impaired at work? And there are changes, I think, that could be proposed to give employers more guidelines on what it means to be impaired at work. Whether those will actually happen or not remains to be seen. If marijuana is legalized, it will create an even greater need for that clarity and definition. So I think we will see changes. I can't tell you when they will happen, but fundamentally it's a safety issue.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour. We've been talking with Peter Lowe, attorney at Brown & Isaacson. We'll be right back as we continue the legal update for 2016 on News Talk WLOB.
Running a company can feel like you're surrounded. A key person quits. A big project presents itself. You need good people fast. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Our contract staffing service will fill a position or find the right talent for a short-term project. Hundreds of companies choose us because we deliver people that fit. Career Management Associates, your contract staffing solution. Go to cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
Dale Carnegie Training specializes in building high-performing individuals and teams, and Dale Carnegie Maine provides public courses that do just that. On January 6, a one-day Step Up to Leadership course. January 21 starts an 8-week Dale Carnegie course. January 25 starts a 3-week Dale Carnegie Sales Training course. To sign up or get more info, go to main.dalecarnegie.com or call 775-3253.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. And today we've been talking with Peter Lowe, employment attorney with Brown and Isaacson, and he has been talking about the year in review. Peter, as we head into the last segment here, I know you have two cases you want to talk about. I think these are great cases to showcase. The first case, of course, is a religious accommodation case having to do with Abercrombie that I know you'll talk about. And the second one is the one, of course, everybody's waiting for, is the one about Deflategate. So I have about 10 seconds for the religious accommodation case, and we'll talk about the rest. No, I'm just kidding. Let's go through both of them.
All right. Yeah, Supreme Court, as you know, takes very, very few cases. Usually there's one or two employment cases, and the case that I was going to talk about for a little bit was the EEOC versus Abercrombie and Fitch stores, which is an important religious accommodation case. A young Muslim woman in this case, applied for a job at Abercrombie, and she was wearing a hijab, the headdress that Muslim women often wear. And Abercrombie did not hire her, and the argument was made, or the case was made, that she certainly was qualified for the job. And the reason that Abercrombie gave for not hiring her was that it had a, and this is the term used, a look policy. And the look policy prohibited employees from wearing head coverings when they were working. So that would be a baseball cap or some other headdress, including the hijab. And this individual brought a case. This happened back in 2008. So here's our legal system. She ultimately had her case resolved in 2015, but it went as far as the Supreme Court of the United States. And actually, the Supreme Court was, I think there was one person in dissent, but it was 8-1. And given the division in the court, that showed pretty clearly that they were viewing this in the same way. And one of the arguments in this case that was made by the employer was she didn't actually request a religious accommodation. She never said, well, by the way, I wear a hijab. It's part of my religious observation. And would you be able to accommodate that? I think the Supreme Court looked at that and said, well, she didn't have to make that request. that it should have been obvious to Abercrombie that that would be an accommodation they should take into account. And they didn't. They simply applied their policy more rigidly than the Supreme Court said they should have. And as a result, she prevailed in that case. And I think, it not only did it clarify or set some parameters for employers in dealing with these types of issues, it reinforced something that every employer should be aware of already, which is, in a situation like that, I don't think, the same with disability, you don't have to wait for somebody to say, is it okay if we do that? Really, it should be more interactive. So I understand with Abercrombie that they didn't want to start discussing religion appropriately during the interview. But if they reached the conclusion that she was qualified and this was the obstacle, then the more appropriate discussion should have been, we're going to offer this person a job. Once we've offered her a job, we'll have a discussion about our policy. And then we'll have a discussion of whether or not it would be reasonable to make an accommodation under this policy. And so that's the lesson learned, and I'm sure Abercrombie have gone that way. Abercrombie, this isn't the first time they've had problems.
No, they certainly have been in the news a lot.
Yeah, I mean, and they paid a very large settlement a number of years ago in a case that really said, Abercrombie have an image and they market to their customers by hiring individuals who meet that image. So young, attractive, primarily white.
Collegiate.
Yeah.
Collegiate.
The collegial, yeah. Preppy look. So that's been an issue that they've wrestled with before and they continue to wrestle with. But this case came out.
Well, I think it does, as you said, give some parameters. I would say that certainly it's almost a no-brainer in this case. This was actually one of those in which when I read through it and looked at it, I went, oh, that's a no-brainer. Really, it probably wasn't the best decision. If you really look at all the details involved having to do with some of the district managers being talked, different things that went on that, it really was a no-brainer in terms of what the court would decide.
Yep, I agree.
In terms of it. All right, so the last and part of this show, we're going to be talking about Deflategate. So how can Deflategate affect HR?
I'm not sure, but I just like talking about it. this is a subject that may be near and dear to many of us here in Maine and in New England, or at least some of us, and others of us may be sick of hearing about Deflategate. But as it was unfolding, I became interested in it not simply as somebody who likes the Patriots and thinks Tom Brady's great, but just the way it was being handled by the NFL and looking at that as an employment lawyer and thinking about, is that really the best move? Is that how to handle an issue? And anybody who knows anything about investigations really should look at what the NFL did and say, we're not going to do many of the things that they did. And just to give you a little snapshot of what I'm talking about, the NFL had one of the stars of their league who was accused, or there was some suspicion that the footballs had been tampered with, and they determined, understandably, that an investigation needed to be launched. Why wouldn't you, first of all, in a high profile case like that, go to someone who truly doesn't have a dog in the fight? Why wouldn't you go to someone and say, we don't have an agenda, we don't know what happened, we want you to do a fair, thorough investigation? The guy they picked was a lawyer and a law firm for the NFL. So is that in the first place, is that truly, and they would bandy around forever that this was
absolutely right.
We went to an independent. No, it wasn't an independent investigator. It was an outside investigator whose firm has been paid millions and millions of dollars by the NFL. Who does he report to? Who does he have a duty to? The NFL. And when you look into this case more closely, you'll see, in my opinion, an incredible institutional bias that tainted an awful amount of what was done. 101 in workplace investigations is that when you do an investigation, you put together the most serious allegations and the evidence that you have potentially to support those, and you ask the witnesses who you interview about those very issues. The NFL paid in excess of $3 million reportedly to Ted Wells and his firm to do this investigation. They had a mountain of information available to them, including, I'm pointing at your phone, they had text messages. And in one of these texts, there was a reference, and these are the texts between the so-called ball boys, who were not boys, by the way. They were quite senior gentlemen like ourselves. And one of the texts referred to I think one of the people referred to himself as a deflator. Now, that there's a reason to be asking, well, what does that mean? Believe it or not, the NFL never asked that individual, what did he mean by that text? They never asked many crucial questions, even though, you know, there's a squadron, there's an army of lawyers on the case. And my last point on this, and there's many more that we can discuss, and this really bears for employers to think about. When you write an investigation report, when you've concluded your work, don't just focus on the bad stuff. Now, you may think, I'm going to terminate this person, so I have to throw in everything that's negative about this person. Well, in the end, if you do that, it looks one-sided. It is one-sided. Instead, you need to include evidence or information that may be exculpatory and explain why you don't consider that swung the investigation in favor of that person. Ted Wells' report, running to hundreds of pages, has zero information in many critical parts about the information that would have been exculpatory to Tom Brady. Just chose to not even include it, not explain why it's not there. So it's a case study, in my view, of how not to write a report. And this is from somebody who no doubt is very experienced, very skillful, knowledgeable. I don't mean to take anything away from him personally. But in this case, I think the NFL was done a disservice because it was a fundamentally flawed process. And I'm going to have the fun of discussing this issue at more length at the Samoset this year.
Yeah, the main HR convention.
Main HR conference. Bud Bernstein, who runs it, asked what I'd like to talk about. I said, would it be all right if I showed some slides, some pictures of Tom Brady to the audience there? And he thought that would be great.
And no, I said, it's perfect. It's perfect. So what we're going to do is, obviously, after that, we would love to have you back on the HR Power Hour for the ones that can't go so they can hear about this case. We'll schedule that sometime in June after the convention. But I think it's perfect that people are going to the convention and absolutely take that course.
Yeah. Well, I hope to make it entertaining and maybe a little bit educational as well.
Well, Peter, thank you for being on the show today. It was a great year in review.
Thank you. Good to be here again, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB. Thank you for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB, 1310 a.m., or streaming live on WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at hrpowerhour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.